Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King.
And I'm Jason Henricks. Every week since 2013, we explore the personalities, startups, innovators, and industry players driving disruption in financial services.
From incumbents to unicorns, and from cutting-edge technology to the people using it to help create a more innovative, inclusive, and healthy financial future. I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks. This episode of Breaking Banks is supported by Banking Circle, the financial infrastructure provider you can bank on. Well, Mark Donohue is founder and managing director of iSky Research. iSky provides a unique window into digital customer experience by monitoring digital banking apps and channels around the world and providing insight into the customer experience. Mark, tell us what's going on in digital banking and how's it changed over the last few months?
Well, good to see you again, JP. It's been a while.
Likewise.
Yeah, it's been a really, really busy few months, to be honest. I mean, with everyone going into lockdown, the focus for a lot of the providers that we look at has really shifted. You know, a lot of that sort of big horizon type thinking that we were seeing, particularly sort of 6 to 12 months ago, has come back a little bit closer to home and a little bit back to some more fundamentals, some basics in terms of making sure that customers can appropriately service their finances and manage their finances whilst they're in lockdown or certainly not able to get around as freely as much as they could before. In that way, we're seeing a lot of focus on really basic things like being able to access statements and deposit checks and just being able to update your profile and a lot of that kind of engagement that isn't perhaps so sexy, but certainly fundamental and necessary to making sure customers can do what they need to do.
Well, currently on iskyresearch.com, you're showing, in the top five is, say, three American and two Australian institutions, USA at the top of the list for desktop, web, and for the iPhone app, USAA also on top of the list. Now, mix it up a little bit more there, BBVA from Spain, Tangerine from Canada, along with Westpac from Australia, and Redwood Credit Union from USA makes it on both lists. I'm not surprised at all that USAA is there. I think they do a terrific job. I'm mildly surprised that we've got multiple American institutions here where we talk a lot on the show about how American institutions are behind the game in a lot of aspects of digital banking. Is that surprising to you?
It is and it isn't. I mean, with the way that we look at the providers that we analyze and that we benchmark, first and foremost, we're concerned with what journeys are available to the customer. What can they do? What can they actually achieve in terms of self-servicing inside of digital channels? So from that perspective, there's a lot of American banks doing really good, really solid work. USAA is absolutely one of them, and they've been doing that for quite some time. Now,
sure.
Some people might be critical of some of the, interface aspects or visuals that are used inside of some of the USAA experiences. Perhaps it could use a little bit of a refresh in terms of that that part of the experience. But when it comes to the availability of functionality, the depth of journeys, the breadth of experience that's available to customers in USAA, and certainly a few of the other providers that you touched on, they're pretty hard to go past. USAA is quite exceptional in that regard. We've long said that they're obviously servicing customers as much as they might be standing in Kansas one day and then in Kabul the next, or wherever it is they find themselves around the world as their service listed service people for the US military in particular. So from that regard, they do incredibly well. BBVA, another one, exceptional functionality, exceptional depth of functionality, and some of those others that you've talked about, Westpac and Commonwealth Bank in Australia, for example. They all have a lot of functionality, but likewise, they all have some similar challenges in terms of helping customers to navigate the experiences and really enjoy the experiences that they're having inside of some of those digital channels. Just because they have more in terms of functionality doesn't always mean that they're necessarily offering the best user experience.
So how do you decide what aspects to measure and how to weight them? I suppose the old phrase, your mileage may vary, applies here, right? Some people might prefer one aspect to something you're measuring, but how do you decide how to weight all the various aspects of everything that you're looking at when you create these rankings?
Well, to us, objectivity is key. We want to make sure that we're, you know, not selling things with our opinions or, you know, the opinion of someone that's on the other side of the world when they're looking at a provider in a European provider that's being assessed by someone in North America or Asia Pacific or wherever it may be. So fundamentally, all of our systems of scoring, all of our methods of scoring and data capturing, they're all objective. And in terms of weighting, we ask the customers themselves. So we actually go out there and we survey customers to find out what are their priorities, what do they want, what do they need, what do they expect from their provider when they log into their digital channel, whether it's an app or whether it's web, and indeed whether it's a business experience or a corporate experience or a personal banking experience. So when it comes to weighting, that's the method that we're using. And our scoring system is a reflection really of two sets of data. It's the data around what is available to customers, and then that second set of data around what the customers want. And so much of our scoring comes down to what they can do and whether or not that's what they want to do. And yeah, there's lots of other conversations we can have when it comes to good and bad experiences. We're always really keen to put up and demonstrate journeys that we think are good or bad or exceptional or worth having a look at because they offer something unique. But when it comes to our scoring methodologies, we absolutely want to stick to making sure that we are objective and in that way that we're providing fact and fact that people can rely upon when they're giving presentations and talking to colleagues.
Now, I saw that you just came out with something new you're calling the friction score. So what is that and why did you add that to your analysis?
We're really excited about the friction score. It's something we've been working on for a while. And, you know, to us, it's going to be a really insightful, really helpful measure that people can use to compare the nuances of individual journeys from different providers around the world. Again, keeping in mind that most people don't get access to as many banks as we get access to. Most people don't get to go and log into USAA and BBVA, just have a look at what they're doing. So we're looking for ways to make sure that our users can have those objective methods and measures to compare and contrast the experiences customers have in specific journeys. And we think with the friction score, they're going to be able to do exactly that, to understand the ease and simplicity or the challenges that the customer might face as they're going through seeking to complete individual journeys. Fundamentally, it's an algorithm that enables us to compute a score that will identify how easy or how hard, how simple or challenging it is for a customer to go from being outside of a digital channel all the way through security at login, all the way through the navigation experience and the journey that they're looking to achieve, whether it's applying for a credit card or checking their balances, downloading a statement, whatever it might be. But in doing all of that, assessing how easy or how hard it is for them to do that. And that way, we think we're adding another really insightful measure to the discussion around good and bad, what constitutes good or bad user experience.
And who uses your research and what do they do with it?
We've got a real diversity of clients. We've got clients around the world on every continent, except Antarctica, of course. Not too many penguins looking.
We'll have to do an episode on that soon, Antarctic banking.
I'm not sure how much use it gets, but there is an ATM down there. We work primarily with banks, but also some other providers as well. We work with other businesses that are seeking to likewise work with banks and inform the discussions that they're having with banks. Communications companies, we've worked with quite a few of those. Even some non-traditional providers that are starting to look in the financial services space. We've worked with a major car manufacturer, a well-known brand that people would be familiar with and some of the work that they've been doing to explore how they can get more into the financial services space. I guess that just demonstrates, you know, how the borders and barriers around financial services are increasingly breaking down and we are seeing other entrants come into the market and looking for ways to engage with customers through payments and other methods to deepen the relationships that they have.
And you're measuring both digital banking and desktop banking. And how's that changing and what are you seeing in the trends from that? Because what I'm seeing, and our frequent contributor, Ron Shevlin, just put out another article on Forbes that he's going to come on the show and talk about. He's looking at digital account opening really moving more to mobile, and it had been surging for a while, and the pandemic only, you know, just accelerated even further, but it was coming before that. Are you seeing the same thing in what you're looking at globally?
Absolutely. And funnily enough, I think just this afternoon before we started our conversation, I've had 3 emails from clients that are all asking about onboarding experiences and the KYC and application journeys and so forth. We've been doing a lot of work in this space of late, and it's certainly a major focus for the discussions that we've been having. We would agree that there is a trend towards banks looking to mobile and the technology that can come with mobile to help enhance that experience for customers that are looking to set up a new account and onboard into the bank, be it through the camera and capture around KYC and identification or other methods that they can benefit from. So certainly agree with that. And I like reading Ron's comments. He's always got a bit of a spark in the way that he presents things. He's always an interesting
fintech. Yeah, the fintech snark tank. Yes.
but no, I think I could fairly say that we would agree with Ron on that one, and that ultimately, you know, we expect that to continue to be a trend as COVID continues to challenge banks and customers in terms of how they can facilitate the relationships that they want to have. Figure out how to be more digital
and
getting customers into a bank.
Yeah, and one of the other things that Ron and his research at Cornerstone Advisors has talked about, not only in his most recent article, but for a while now, is how really it's the mega banks in the U.S., right? It's the Wells Fargos, the J.P. Morgan Chase, the Bank of America's who are really leading this. And that trend shows up in your research at iSky Research as well. But again, let's go back to your top 5 list, Redwood Credit Union. That is not a large institution, and they're in the top 5 for you, both in desktop web and in the iPhone app. They're kind of an outlier, aren't they? Credit unions are not showing up really well in a lot of these things, and they're not a big, I think they're about a $5 billion institution, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, we look at a number of credit unions around the world, and I suppose in that way, Redwood is a bit of a standout. They certainly surprised us when we looked at them. We only got first access to them only a few months ago, but it was a really welcome surprise to see some of the things that they've been doing in terms of servicing customers and fundamentally the depth that they had built into the channels that they're offering to customers in terms of that self-service. So certainly very welcome to see that. Credit unions, you know, it can be mixed results. There are certainly others that have done pretty well around the world. Coast Capital up in BC does some pretty good work just north of where you are. And there's a couple in Australia that aren't doing too badly as well. But generally speaking, I would agree that, you know, most of the drive around the technological innovation tends to come from within the organizations that have the pockets and the depth of pockets to be able to, you know, really invest in that space.
Yeah. So how does an organization like Redwood Credit Union get on your radar screen? Did somebody request that you specifically take a look at them, or did they come onto your radar another way? You had heard about them. How's that usually happen?
It's pretty much one of those two ways, JP.
those are the two primary ways.
That's pretty much it. Yeah. It's generally because we'll have someone approach us and say, hey, we'd like to know where we fit in your rankings, knowing that we have access to hundreds of banking channels around the world. They like to say, hey, can you have a look at us and tell us where we're going or how we're going? But likewise, we will often have existing clients that will say to us, hey, we'd really like to know if you can have a look at this provider or this competitor or that competitor and tell us what they're up to and what they're doing. So, you know, that's really key to what we do as a business. Access is pretty fundamental to the work that we do, and it's pretty critical in terms of the relationships that we have with our clients. So we're always looking to expand that and always happy to take their lead on the types of experiences and providers they'd like to see.
So do you actually go out and open an account then at those institutions?
We do. Yeah, we do. Well, I mean, there's a mix of ways that we do it. Obviously, you know, every country is different, every jurisdiction is different. You've got to deal with the KYC and the regulatory requirements that are shaping the journey for the customer in terms of opening a new bank account. So certainly amongst the business, we have a lot of bank accounts, but likewise, we work with a number of providers around the world, a number of collaborators that we have around the world that help us to get some of that access. But ultimately, the most important thing for us is to have that live access. It's really critical to the work that we do, because without having the live access and without being able to iterate the work that we do, which, you know, every 4 months we're going and updating our benchmarks. Every single data point we have inside of our system gets updated every 4 months to make sure that we're reflecting the truest, newest experiences that are available to customers. So, you know, in doing that, we have to make sure that we maintain that access to iterate those journeys and ultimately identify those trends and those innovations as they're occurring.
Well, and that's critical. Bank and credit union leaders are always looking to benchmark and try to understand what else is out there, what target are we trying to hit, and being able to access, you know, not only their competitors, but standard bearers from, you know, other parts of the country or other parts of the world can really be helpful for them. Regionally, you know, whether this is by country or, you know, continent or whatever, where do you think is the most competitive area where you've got the most kind of high-performing organizations really battling?
I'm absolutely going to offend someone no matter what I say now.
That's okay. I'm curious, from your research, where do you think is the most competitive market for digital mobile banking?
They're so different continent to continent, right? So if you look at, let's broadly, I suppose, talk about, say, North America, Europe, and Asia, and apologies to everyone in Latin America and Africa who might be listening. It's not to say that we're ignoring, but, you know, just focusing on those two for a moment.
Right.
So yeah, the drive in Southeast Asia, the dynamic is so different in many ways because of the spread of some of those super apps that we've seen originate in China, but also in other markets like Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, you know, Gojek in Indonesia is doing some amazing work. That kind of dynamic is really shaping and reshaping the expectation of customers in terms of what they're expecting to get from their banks. And I think in many ways, banks are looking to those types of providers as much as they're looking to traditional banks and even challenger banks to you know, see what that innovation and next experience is going to look like.
So you're talking about the influence of the Alibabas, the Tencent, the Baidu, those sorts of things that didn't come from the traditional financial service, financial institutions, right? Came more from the e-commerce side.
Yeah, and likewise, the, you know, the Paytms in India and the Grabs in Malaysia and Singapore, and you know, for people that may not be familiar with some of these names, you know, they're a kind of reflection of the Ubers and the Amazons of North America and Europe and so forth.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, those providers, I mean, if you measure success by the number of customers that they've managed to pick up just in the last few years, you know, those are companies that have gone from zero to hundreds of millions, if not billions of customers across some of those brands. Impressive no matter how you cut that up and look at it. But to each of them, you see a fairly similar formula that's playing out, where they're identifying a market, they're getting into that market, they're realizing that payments are fundamental to the commerce that they're trying to drive, and once they've built up the payments functionality and you know, typically a wallet or something of that kind of nature into their experience, they're likewise then realizing that, you know, we can do so much more, we can sell so much more, there's so much more that we can do in terms of engaging with our customers, not just in our traditional market, but also in a diversified market, and likewise bringing other commercial partners into their ecosystems and their experiences. So yeah, it's I love watching it. I love seeing it, and just being able to talk to people about it is always really exciting, because it's such a different dynamic to what we see in those sort of North American and European markets.
Well, what about the flip side? What markets do you think have really a lot of upside to go maybe not as competitive?
I think that there's still a lot of upside in North America. I think that there's still a lot of potential for really radical changes in terms of experience in North America.
Well, particularly in the U.S., because we have so many institutions, right? We can talk about the mega banks, but, you know, we called out one small credit union. There are a lot of community-based and mid-sized organizations that have an opportunity, I think, to, you know, really improve. And that's not just and sorry, I'm already getting you off to a second question here, because I want to hear your answer. But I also want you to maybe think about one of the things we've talked about, and we've been focused a lot on strategy lately, Jason and I just kind of talked about this. Most institutions can't win the flat arms race. So they have to find ways to compete uniquely. and ways to serve their customers, you know, more intimately. And that doesn't necessarily mean face-to-face, though. It still may mean and likely means digital and mobile banking. But so anyway, back to, you know, kind of the first question, then embedded to the second question is, you know, with opportunities in North America and what, where are those opportunities? What can organizations do to compete if they don't have, you know, billions of dollars to spend?
Yeah, to me, there's so much untapped potential around the way that data is being used, shared, and leveraged in particularly in the North American market. And I think that probably goes for Canada almost as much as it goes for the US, but you know, both of them have sort of different dynamics around that. You know, we're seeing a lot of opening up in Europe, and it's being driven by a different sort of circumstances, a set of circumstances to what we were just talking about in terms of Southeast Asia and Asian providers. But nonetheless, similar sorts of dynamics in terms of the flow of data and information around the customer, personal information, financial information, et cetera, et cetera. We haven't really seen that opening up in the North American experience quite as much as we've seen in some of those other markets. So to me, that's one really large area of potential in particularly in the US, as you say, but also it brings a great risk, right? There's this challenge that goes with that, which is to say that, you know, as data becomes more accessible and more available, if the banks and the traditional providers are not really thinking about how they can turn that into an enhanced experience and service for the customer, they're opening themselves up increasingly to risk that someone else will be able to tap into that data and bring that service to the relationship that they may not be able to offer. I often say when we're talking about open banking that we've reached this point in banking history, which, you know, has never been experienced before, where data and product are being separated for the first time. And you know, there are going to be some banks that end up being product banks because they don't figure out the service side of things. And really, to me, one of those absolute focus points for banks right now in terms of thinking through their strategy and what they're doing going forward is, what are we doing to service the customer as much as what are we doing in terms of the fees, rates, and costs around the product? You know, if we're not having those kinds of conversations, it might be a little bit too late to start them in a few years from now.
Well, and one of those things for a lot of the smaller institutions is on the commercial side. And you mentioned that too. So you're not just looking at consumer accounts, right? You're looking at commercial and corporate accounts as well?
Yeah, we are. We've got access to quite a large number of SME and corporate type accounts with different providers around the world. And the experiences that we see typically with the SME and corporate providers tends to be a sort of step or two behind what we would see with the personal slash retail banking type space. You know, it tends right. to be led by that consumer space in terms of the digital experience.
So you think there's, I'm assuming that that's where there is some opportunity, and especially for some of these organizations that we're talking about that aren't running the mega consumer banks, but they have these small businesses and they have an opportunity to really service them in a unique way. So I suspect there's a long way to run yet for improving digital and mobile banking services for small, medium, and large businesses.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And to a degree, there's a need to start thinking about those segments in different ways as well, right? You know, the small to medium business is often so intertwined with what the personal slash retail banking relationship would be as well. You know, how can you make sure that those two things are working? That Venn diagram is getting closer and closer together in terms of the overlap. But fundamentally, corporate banking absolutely could use a massive overhaul. With many of the providers that we look at, you know, very, very fractured, fragmented kinds of experiences that we see, very low engagement through mobile, you know, very little in terms of functionality being available to customers in mobile, which is, you know, not to say that every customer needs to have that access, but there are certainly improvements that we're seeing in those other segments that could then flow through to corporate. But, we don't always see with some of the larger providers that we look at.
Well, you talked about the influence of the non-banks in Asia in particular, but when we think about the neobanks, we talk a lot about neobanks on the show. We're a big fan of the concept, and with Brett and Jason both being early founders in the space, no wonder. But they're not showing up, at least at the very top of your list. How are you seeing the neobanks competing from a user experience perspective? Because for many of them, that's how they hold out that that's what they say is different about them. We are a better user experience, but you're not necessarily seeing that in the research I'm seeing from you.
Well, it's not to say that they're not offering a good or even better user experience, but what we're typically seeing with the challenger banks or the neobanks that we don't see with the traditional banks is more of a niche focus around a lot of them, where they're going after a particular market segment. A lot of them have tried to go after the millennial type market, for example, where they're really sort of honing their brand and message they're offering to that particular segment that they go for. And that's reflected in the depth of experience that they give to the customer, right? They're very focused on financial management tools and sort of financial health and literacy engagement, or many of them have done well with cards management. Likewise, we've seen a lot of crossover in terms of marketplace and commercial offerings, where you can, you know, access a non-financial services provider through these types of challenger banks, and even some going so far as to give you access to go and buy artworks from a third party, etc. So they tend to be a little bit more focused in that way, and a little bit more niche in that way than what you would get with the traditional providers. You know, traditional providers have to deal with not only a customer segment that tends to be more diverse, but also a product segment that, of course, tends to be more diverse. Where your challenger banks, many of them only have current / savings accounts, checking accounts, whatever you want to call them. Many of them aren't getting into the lending type space, the credit type space, the investment type space that we would see from traditional providers, and, of course, all the functionality that would go with that.
Well, and part of what I'm seeing, and I'm curious if you're seeing this in your research as well, is the large traditional institutions can catch up pretty quickly. So if a neobank has a really interesting feature or UX design or something, and a big bank likes it, they've got a lot of resources they can put against that and launch something pretty similar and blunt the attack of that new feature pretty quickly.
Absolutely. And we're seeing that also play out in our data as well. One of the great benefits to the work that we've been doing over the years is that, of course, because we track and benchmark in the way that we do, we've been doing that historically and iteratively. We're also able to see and understand the cadence that banks are having in terms of the releases they're putting out the market. And there's a shift. There's a definite shift that's going on at the moment, where those traditional providers that had been in many cases a little bit slow in terms of their releases and updates and growth, really starting to increase that cadence and increase what they're putting out, the frequency with which they're putting new experiences into the marketplace and ultimately innovating. A lot of the benefits that challenger providers have had in terms of being more agile, in terms of being more nimble, being smaller, and perhaps a little bit, more focused and with more advanced tech stacks or more recent tech stacks, they had that agility that the traditional providers didn't necessarily have, but we're seeing that change.
Right.
It's definitely flow through to the consumer side of things.
So if you were leading mobile banking at an institution that's not showing up at the top of your research list, I mean, are there one or two kind of common things that people should really address pretty quickly to solve some of the biggest gaps that you're seeing?
There's so many. I think the one of the fundamental challenges that we see with a lot of providers right now, which doesn't always necessarily play out in terms of the sort of nuance of individual journey, is navigation. So many providers, as we start to pack more and more experiences and more depth of functionality into channels, we often lose sight of the simplicity and the ease with which customers ought to be able to navigate around and access the experiences that we're offering to them as banks. We're seeing banks that are having multiple menus set up on a single screen and differing navigational touch points. And it's you can have a really great depth, and there are certainly providers in North America and in America that would be reflective of this. You've got a lot of depth of functionality. You've got a lot of journey and a lot of self-servicing being available, but just finding some of these things and getting around them and navigating them just becomes infuriating.
Sometimes less is more, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that would definitely be one. Some of the real innovation of late has been in cards. I think cards and personal management of cards and self-management of cards is one of those areas that if you're not putting out pretty regular updates to at the moment, you're probably a little bit behind the curve. We should be able to lock cards, change pins, request new cards. These are some of the more fundamental things that I think we can say pretty confidently that a majority of providers that we look at now are offering to customers. You know, there's innovation that goes well beyond that. But if you want to be making sure that you're keeping up with the pack, some of the cards management functionality should be on your list of things to do as well. Likewise, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier, how are you helping customers to leverage their data, use their data, manage their data, and ultimately giving them a deeper insight or benefit or service as a consequence of having that information and that data that they can choose or not choose to share with you, depending if they want to bring more data in or share more data out.
Right. Well, some great tips for people. And well, Mark Donahue from iSky Research, thanks for being here. How can people find out more about iSky Research and get a hold of your data?
It's pretty easy. Just head to iskyresearch.com. That's iskyresearch.com. You'll find us on Twitter. You'll find us on LinkedIn. But head to the website or you can email me directly. It's just Mark, M-A-R-K, at iskyresearch.com. And be happy to have a chat to you and show you what we're working on. But any of those methods, you'll get us pretty quick.
Great. Mark, great to have you back on the show.
Great to talk to you, JP. Stay safe. I hope things calm down on the west coast of the US. No more wildfires and so forth. Fingers crossed for you all. And all the best challenging times.
So far, so good. Thank you. Banking Circle's proprietary technology enables payments businesses and banks of any scale to seize opportunities, compete, and grow. From multi-currency accounts to fast access to lending services, international payments and local clearing to real-time FX, Banking Circle solutions are quick, low-cost, and secure. Bypass legacy systems and enable global banking services for your clients. Banking Circle, the financial infrastructure provider you can bank on. Find out more at bankingcircle.com. It's almost the weekend, so I'm looking forward to spending some more time with Ron Howard, and then hopefully with Judd Apatow if I have time, on Masterclass. Last weekend, I started Ron Howard's Masterclass on directing, and after I finish that, I'll start Judd Apatow's on comedy. Actually, I still have to finish the one from David Sedaris on humor and storytelling. There's so much to choose from. I love learning from creative people and applying their lessons in my own work. I already have future weekends planned with Malcolm Gladwell, Helen Mirren, and Bob Iger. Maybe you'd rather learn cooking skills from Gordon Ramsay, or skateboarding with Tony Hawk, or gymnastics with Simone Biles. Where else can you learn directly from world-class experts like this? The production quality is excellent, and each class is broken down into 10 to 15 minute lessons so you can learn from the world's best minds anytime, anywhere, and at your own pace. You'll also get downloadable lesson recaps and supplemental materials. They offer a ton of classes, and you can take them anytime you want, right on your phone, tablet, or computer, and you don't even have to wait for the weekend. I highly recommend you check it out. Get unlimited access to every masterclass, and as a Breaking Banks listener, you get 15% off the annual all-access pass. Go to masterclass.com/banks. That's masterclass.com/banks for 15% off Masterclass. If you work for a bank or credit union, you already know that this budgeting and planning season is filled with more uncertainty and risk than ever before. And the answers you need aren't in your boardroom or in your spreadsheet models. The team at Alloy Labs has worked with some of the world's most innovative financial institutions, and now our Alloy Co-Labs can help you benefit from multiple perspectives as you learn hands-on how to apply industry-leading tools and frameworks to help you forge ideas into results quickly and cheaply. You can learn more at alloylabs.com/colabs, C-O-L-A-B-S.
Our strategy collabs will help you prioritize what are always limited resources to defend and extend your core business while creating viable options for the future. And our customer discovery collabs will help you build a deeper understanding of your customers' changing needs. These are short, hands-on virtual sessions that'll help you get results fast. Space is extremely limited, so go to alloylabs.com/collabs to register now. Times of great change are also times of great opportunity, and the time to act is now. alloylabs.com/collabs.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
And now, here's more Breaking Banks. Well, back once again is Ron Shovlin, Director of Research for Cornerstone Advisors. Ron's been a management consultant for more than 25 years. He's worked with leading financial service, consumer product, retail, manufacturing companies all over the world. He's a regular contributor to Breaking Banks and a senior contributor to Forbes. Ron, when you're on the show, I always have to figure which of the last recent articles we want to talk about. And I will talk about at least two. We talked earlier on the show with Mark Donahue from iSky Advisors. We talked about digital bank account opening, and you wrote a report, you know, very recently entitled Digital Account Opening Surged Long Before the Pandemic. And then with kind of a subhead, Thanks to Bank of America and Chase. And so you talk about the mega banks in particular, but maybe just take us through your findings there at a high level. I want to drill down on that a little bit. And then I want to also talk about banks need to innovate or not, because that's another article that you wrote that has already had a lot of good conversation on social media, and we ought to talk about it here on the show. So digital account opening, what is happening there post-pandemic, and what are the seeds that led to that before the pandemic?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, JP, as always. It was interesting timing on the part of this survey. It was conducted right at the beginning of July. So right at the beginning of Q3 2020, right after Q2 ended. And, you know, from the pandemic perspective, you know, certainly not at the height of it at that point, and maybe we weren't quite out of it yet, but clearly not at the depth of it. So, you know, able to kind of look back over the past, the prior 6 months, to see, what had been happening from a financial services perspective. The survey I conducted, again, as always, representative of the U.S. Adult population and by gender, age, ethnic background, and geography. And that's just for the people who love to pick on my results and say, well, maybe it wasn't representative. And it was.
Well, if you didn't survey me, it wasn't a valid research survey, right? Because feel differently. Therefore, your methodology must have been suspect.
I must be wrong somewhere. Listen, as a guy with a wife and three daughters, I'm pretty used to being told I'm wrong about everything. But so I got a little defensive in these realms. But, you know, I tried to do something a little different here, JP. I actually asked consumers, when did you last open a checking account and in what channel did you use? And then I also asked, when you opened that last checking account, was it your primary account or was it for a secondary or third or fourth type of account? And so what I really was able to do is get sort of through one survey, get a bit of a timeline on, channel behavior over time, because I asked specifically about their behavior in Q2 2020 and Q1 2020 and then 2019, 2018 and 2017 and before that. So here's sort of the top level findings. It isn't surprising anybody that the percentage of checking account applications that are being taken digitally, that is both online and mobile, has been increasing. And in Q2 2020, I think that number was absolutely phenomenal. I think it was about 66%, if I remember correctly. Now, man, did I screw up big time. When I published the article on Forbes, I focused on, hey, Q2 second quarter applications were 66% digital.
Yeah, and maybe we should be clear about that. Q2 in this case doesn't mean the fintech company called Q2. You mean the second quarter of the year 2020.
Absolutely. There's a plug for them. Good. They'll owe you for that one.
Unintentional.
But, you know, I published the article with that title, and then the response was, like, pretty tepid. Nobody was reading the article because everybody felt like, yeah, we knew that. Big deal. There was a pandemic going on. The branches weren't open. And that's what made me realize, like, no, you guys don't understand. Yes, there was a bump up in Q2 as the branches closed. But the crossing point of digital and branches actually crossed sometime in mid 2019.
I thought it was actually earlier than that. I thought I saw research. I remember, I want to say it was 2015, that at least total so you're talking about account opening.
Account opening, yes.
Okay, because I think transactions actually crossed in 2015. So now we're even to originations.
Yeah. Transactions, I'm sure, happened long before that.
Gotcha.
But account openings happen now. And I should note, and we should note, since, Brett King is the grandfather of breaking banks, the great-grandfather of breaking banks, and that he predicted that it would happen in 2018, back in Bank 2.0, I think. And so it happened a year later, and, you know, that's pretty good for a futurist to be only a year off. So we got to give him a lot of credit for that.
Well, because the real job of the futurist is to make so many predictions, you can't keep track of them all, and some are bound to come true.
That's right. And if it happened in 2018, he would have just claimed to have been dyslexic. I mean, if it happened in 2081, he just would have claimed to have been dyslexic. But, you know, what's the funny thing is that there are a lot of people who hear that and go, well, yeah, no big surprise. But, you know, if you talk to most from bankers at mid-sized institutions, both banks and credit unions, JP, their numbers are around 10%,
right?
You know, and even less. So they look at this data and go, no way. No freaking way is that happening. And so what they're really missing the boat on is what's really driving this application. And it's being driven, which is why I mention of Bank of America and JP Morgan Chase in the headline of the revised article title. And if I had more room, I would have given credit to Wells Fargo in there as well. But it's really the domination of the mega banks as, you know, because I look at, you know, I ask consumers about their activity over time, you know, what's happening over the past 3 years is that as a percentage of new account openings, the mega banks are just, you know, cleaning up. They're, you know, they accounted for 55% of the new applications in Q2 and, you know, just constantly quarter over quarter, year over year for the past few years, they've been gaining traction. The other component to that are the digital banks, you know, the neobanks, challenger banks, whatever you want to call them, who accounted for almost 1 out of 5 of the new applications in Q2. And that was up from something like 3% back in 2017, when granted there weren't as many of them around, but, you know, a lot were still around. And so, you know, this is not just, and I think this is an important point, this is not necessarily about channel preferences and that consumers prefer to open up accounts in digital channels. They're opening up the accounts in digital channels because the providers that they are opening those accounts with have great, or at least damn pretty good, damn good account opening tools. And so, you know, that to me is kind of the headline here. This isn't about channel preferences as much as it is about choice of providers. Now, before you jump in, I got one more point to kind of throw in here. And this is one that I think is super important, and I'm really not doing a good job of getting people to understand this. There was a, you know, somewhat of a, I wouldn't call it a huge difference, but there was definitely a noticeable difference in behavior of consumers who were opening up what ultimately was their primary checking account from those that were opening up what they consider to be a secondary or, you know, additional checking account. And because the challenger banks have been increasing their share of that type of checking account, the percentage of applications for secondary checking accounts in Q2 was nearly 3/4. And again, it's being driven a lot by the mega banks, but because of the challenger banks as well. And what's happening here is that, you know, in the last survey I did, about a third of consumers, 35%, have more than one checking account now. So as they add checking accounts for lots of different reasons, many of those accounts are being opened up in digital channels. And, you know, a lot of the bankers I talk to will say, oh, yeah, consumers still open up checking accounts in branches because they need help in making the right choice. Well, two things. Number one, this isn't rocket science, guys. They don't really need that kind of help. But especially for the secondary accounts, they there isn't as much assistance that is needed when, even if it is needed. So, these are some really big behavioral changes that are happening.
Well, you've given us so much to unpack there, but let's stay with your most recent point there. This idea of opening secondary accounts, and I think we've talked about this a little bit on the show before. I've definitely been talking about it with a lot of the banks that I work with. And, you know, the conventional wisdom, and more than conventional, backed by research for decades, was this idea that you need to be top of wallet. You need to be the primary bank for your customers. And, you know, from there, all good things follow, including cross-sell of additional product and so on. And I'm wondering if this is leading to a place where, you know, that's no longer true. That we've got different, and you've talked about this for a long time too, your famous quote that checking accounts have become paycheck motels, the money checks in and checks out again. What do you think is happening with people opening secondary and tertiary, whatever accounts? Why do I need multiple accounts at multiple providers? What's the consumer behavior that's driving that?
Yeah, let me see if I can give you kind of an analogy and think of something. What it comes down to is specialization of needs. You know, it's we don't need, you know, it's not a best of breed type of a thing. Maybe to a certain extent it is, but what it really is sort of this micro management of the financial life, which says, okay, I want to max out on my debit card rewards, so I'll go to a bank that has the best debit card rewards. But because they don't really have any branches near me, I don't really want to do all my business with them. So I'll still have this other bank that will have my direct deposits. And in case they screw up, I can at least, you know, drive down or walk down to the branch and do something. And then, you know, I need this other provider because I want to get really good personal financial management tools. And so, you know, I'll just aggregate my accounts with them, so they'll have the aggregated view of things and I get all the good PFM tools, but I have this other guy for my rewards and I have this other bank for this. And then we haven't even touched, you know, the investment and wealth management side of the coin where, you know, yeah, I got a Merrill Lynch account for my main money, but, you know, I got my play money with Robinhood and then I use Stash for these kinds of things and then I got something else for that. So it's sort of this, you know, mass proliferation of tools. And it isn't about, you know, just having multiple accounts and providers. It's really, I think, this, you know, desire for sort of specialization for the particular objective. And look, the reality of the situation is because there's such easy money movement, there may be some fees sometimes associated with it, but for the most part, you know, if it's just an ACH transaction, it's fairly simple. And even if it's not in real time, it's manageable for what most people are trying to do. So they're moving this money around a lot.
So in 2020, are we finally putting a stake through the heart of the idea of the financial supermarket? Is that idea finally dead?
I think the idea of the supermarket with only one brand in the soup on the shelves was dead a long time ago. I mean, I don't think that, the idea of a platform, though, that offers multiple providers and choice, I don't think that's anywhere even close to having been played out, especially here in the U.S. You know, love what Starling is doing in the U.K. And I think, you know, they're learning and evolving that platform over time in terms of, you know, number of providers needed, types of providers needed, and how to integrate and do that sort of thing. And then, you know, in the U.S., we may have a completely different model where, you know, the Amazons and the Googles are the platforms instead of the financial services providers or even challenger banks. But the supermarket concept with just one brand on the shelf, and it's not even the right analogy, JP, because, you know, I remember it was, Citibank back in the 80s that was really kind of pushing the supermarket. But these aren't necessarily about accounts as they are capabilities, financial management capabilities, automated savings, rewards and reward, you know, optimization types of things, bill negotiation and bill tracking and payment stuff. You know, these are capabilities. And because the digital and mobile and online banking platforms for many banks, none of them are perfect. And, you know, the larger ones are leading the way from a feature and functionality perspective. What happens is people are, you know, picking individual providers to manage individual types of features and functions and optimize on it. So, you know, the supermarket concept is sort of, you know, the product or account level. This is more at the feature functionality level. And, you know, there's still a lot of need for somebody to come in and, you know, kind of help really manage this integrated in a better way. But look, it seems like consumers are going along, you know, and managing in this world.
Well, I'm old enough to remember when my local Sears store had a Dean Witter office and an Allstate agent sitting next to them, right? That was probably in the mid-80s, the epitome of that financial supermarket. So, I mean, if that line of thinking is correct, and I think it probably is what you've just said, if you're a community-based or mid-sized organization, you really have to kind of pick a fork in the road, don't you? You either need to be much better at specializing in a particular set of customers, or you need to really open up and be that platform where you're going to bring in a lot more fintech partners to be able to meet these individual needs.
Yeah, so a couple of thoughts on that, JP. First of all, I've been harping for at least a couple of years now that for the mid-sized and smaller institutions, you know, taking a niche approach from a segmentation perspective is absolutely needed. You got to pick who you're going to be good at and go after that particular segment. I floated another idea in the Forbes article that I published, I guess it was this week at this point, where I said, listen, maybe for the mid-sized financial institutions, they shouldn't even strive to be the primary checking account and should really go, you know, build some, you know, key capabilities in a few areas that differentiate from what the big banks have, and you know, try to compete for the secondary accounts. And I can tell you that did not go over well with a couple of people on LinkedIn for sure. I got some comments of that because it's so kind of radical thinking that the community banks and credit unions would say, well, we don't want their primary business, but it might be a great way to get consumers in the door. I'm looking forward to fielding the survey I'm writing right now. It probably won't be in the field for a couple weeks. But what I'm really going to try to capture in this next survey is less about the account ownership and utilization, and more about the sort of the affinity and the emotional attachment that consumers have to all these ancillary providers. You know, Jim Maroos, who's on the show a lot and runs Digital Banking Report and publisher of Financial Brand, you know, he talks a lot about how, yeah, he's got a bank that he sticks his paycheck in, but that he really considers PayPal to be his primary provider. And my premise, and what I want to test out in this next survey, is that I think that they might find more affinity. You know, I'm really going to just ask the question, here's some of the companies you are doing business with from a financial services perspective. Who do you like? I think it's a like kind of a thing and value proposition. And I'm expecting to find that a lot of consumers will say they like and get value from providers like Stash and Acorns more than they get value from their primary bank. And so this, you know, really puts a, you know, stake in the ground, you know, in the hearts of the community banks and credit unions continue to think, you know, yeah, this is our bread and butter. We're so, you know, our members and customers love us. It's like, I'm not so sure that that's kind of the case anymore. I think the role of the bank has changed. And I'm sure Brett's listening to this and laughing, going, I said this 10 years ago. Why aren't you guys listening? You know, but I think, you know, the rest of the world, we're kind of catching up to that realization.
Well, and the whole idea of liking a brand and what that means, of course, has layers and layers beneath that too, right? You might like your community bank for their community involvement or your credit union and the affinity group that they serve and all that, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to put all of your transactions there because you've got particular needs that you need to have met. And if they're not going to be able to meet them, you're going to go find another one. And that's what has really changed in this fintech revolution over the past decade and a half now is I have multiple choices for every single financial job I need to get done. And by default, it was pretty easy. And I call it conventional wisdom, right, of being a primary banking account. If I had my account somewhere, that was just the first thought. And other choices were somewhat, similar variations on the same theme. You know, I could go to bank X, Y, or Z, but in my mind as a consumer, they're all pretty similar. But now if I've got a specific need for a financial need or a job that I need to get done, there are lots of people who can convince me they're really the expert at this. And yeah, that plays into your other article about, do banks need to innovate or not? Do you have a great way of, do you write your own headlines, or does the editor do that, by the way, Ron?
No, you can tell by how poorly some of the articles do. It's all mine. My wife has taken to like researching what makes great headlines, and even some of that's just not resonating. So it's hit or miss, but my headlines, I have to take all the blame.
Well, you are never afraid to put yourself out there and take the arrows. So the article you published in the middle of September was, banks don't have to innovate. Now, that through line doesn't go all the way through your story. That's not exactly what you said, but that's exactly what the headline says. And you made a number of points in there. What did you mean about that? You really kind of poked a hole in this whole idea that if banks don't innovate, they're going to be disrupted, so we got to go innovate. What was your overarching point?
Are you a movie buff by any chance, JP?
Maybe. Sometimes, right? It depends. What I meant by maybe was, you're going to mention a movie and I may or may not be able to reference it. So give it a shot.
Well, typical, I blank out of the name of the movie. It's the Paul of Newman course. Movie where... the captain says, what we have here is a failure to communicate. And I think that's...
I do know that one. That's Cool Hand Luke.
Cool Hand Luke. Thanks a lot. This is why I write, because when I speak, I can't remember anything. But at least when I write, I can go look it up. This I think, is really at the heart of the matter. You know, it's funny, we're talking about account opening. When you ask banks, what are you doing from an innovation perspective? The top thing at their list is digital account opening. That's not innovation. That's, you're just catching up. But here's, I think, what's the root of the problem. Banks feel the pressure of what's kind of going on in the market, and senior management says and proclaims, we need to innovate. And they use that term, we need to innovate. The board says, you guys need to innovate. And what happens is the rank and file of the organization translates that to mean, they want us to go invent something.
Right.
Innovation equals invent. When really what they're saying is, we need to change. We need to do something different. And that's, maybe this is all semantics, that it's, if doing something different is innovating. But the point is that, there's a lot of people in the organization who, when they hear, we must innovate, think that we have to invent or create something new. And so what happens? They go run off. What's the first thing they do is they go run off and do a brainstorming meeting.
Yes, lots of post-it notes on a whiteboard.
And to be clear, where, quote, no idea is a bad idea, and which is why I don't facilitate those meetings, because let's face it, 95% of those ideas are bad ideas. And to be fair, maybe they're not bad ideas, but really what they are not good innovation or change ideas. They're often things that are posited in the form of, we could do this or we could do that, instead of looking at it from the perspective of, what are the problems that aren't being solved in the market that we should go address and attack?
Right.
And so, another way to kind of look at this is, I go back to Christensen, the guru of innovation and innovator's dilemma, where he basically said, look, it's not everybody, not the incumbent's job is to really kind of, figure out where to start and how to react to it. There was another study I referenced in the article. I forgot where it came from. It might have been from Wharton, where the study that these academics did said that, in many cases, what happens with the innovations from startups is that they get acquired and assimilated into incumbent's business.
Right.
And so they said that, look, the role of the incumbent vis-a-vis innovation is to monitor, acquire, and deploy. Now, when you think about what banks have been doing for the past 40 years, JP, that's exactly it. They've been monitoring, acquiring, deploying. Now, acquire, I'm using that to mean buy, purchase, right. not take over from a, you know, a legal structure perspective, but, you know, look at every one of the innovations, ATMs, online banking, mobile banking, bill pay, e-statements, you know, up and down the line, these things are all incorporated into banks. To hammer on them for not having been the inventor of those capabilities is nonsense. It's ridiculous. You know, that's never going to be the case where incumbents are always the inventors of these new creations, but they stay alive because they're able to help scale, deploy and you know, deliver these capabilities to the masses. And that's exactly what they've been doing. And so, you know, the challenge continues to be, here's what I think is different though. For the better part of 30, 40 years, banks have been monitoring, acquiring, and deploying for internal purposes, internal productivity. They've improved their internal. The next wave that we saw were the outward facing things like online banking and mobile banking. But really what those were doing was, you know, capabilities and inventions or innovations were doing was creating new ways to access existing products. And I think where a lot of banks just aren't clear, thinking clearly enough, is that this next wave of sort of innovation, monitoring, acquisition, and deployment is really about new products, new services, and new capabilities, not new delivery mechanisms for existing products. So it's not about a new way to access your checking account or new ways to transfer money between your checking account and your savings account. It's new products and services. It's new ways of, you know, optimizing and managing your financial life that goes well beyond, you know, just budgeting like PFM did. And so I think that's part of the angst that a lot of banks are feeling around this innovation is that they have been responding to innovation for 30, 40 years, but this is a new phase we're going into, having evolved from internal focus to external focus of delivery of existing products and services to this new world of, wow, you know, these are new products, new services we haven't even, you know, thought of yet, and how do we assimilate and deploy them?
Well, and you know, as you know, I'm a big fan of Christensen and a big subscriber also his jobs theory, that the idea of, you know, people hire products to do jobs for them. And the more we can understand the nuances of that job, the better that we can innovate. And this is where a lot of bank innovation programs go wrong, because they start with a blue sky and a whiteboard and a stack of post-it notes, come up with a whole bunch of ideas that aren't really going to lead anywhere. And so the jobs theory of, right, people have jobs to be done, and if we can understand those and we can help them achieve those jobs, we're going to be a lot better off, because we're actually solving a problem that the customers care about. And so this whole idea that incumbents have a lot to protect, so it's not just go out and think up a bunch of new things we haven't done before. It's how do we make sure that our customers, how do we understand the jobs our customers need to have done, and then find those other jobs they don't have done, and find the other customers who need to have these kind of jobs done. So again, it's not you know, it's not the don't innovate, even though, you know, you boldly call that out in your headline. But it's understanding what innovation is, and that's not necessarily invention. It's not coming up with completely new things. It's about applying new ideas around the jobs that the customers actually have to get done. And what has been so interesting about innovation in financial services is for decades, centuries, the jobs were perceived to be pretty simple. And so every financial institution came up with a similar set of tools and products that allowed those jobs. But as the world's become more complex and people are more complex, our lives are more complex, we have all these kind of micro jobs. And, you know, the startups have, you know, you could, you know, fill your phone with, you know, 100 different startup apps to solve different kind of micro problems. And the banks sometimes lose sight of that and focus on, you know, the large macro. And the sweet spot somewhere in between, right? Solving those individual needs for the customers, but being able to do it in a scalable way and process.
Right. Well, remember, JP, I didn't say banks can't innovate, and I didn't say banks shouldn't innovate. I said banks don't have to, because the, as you mentioned, you know, the familiar rallying cry these days is if banks don't innovate, they'll die or be disrupted or whatever. I'm like, no, that's just not true. It's they don't have to innovate if they're doing a good job of monitoring, acquire, deploying, and doing that fast enough, which could get us into sort of the whole fast follower thing. But I'm pretty sure we probably don't have enough time to get into that.
Well, not this time, but Ron, you'll always be back again soon. I appreciate you being a regular contributor here, and I always enjoy our conversations around this. So you can read Ron at Forbes. You can find him at Cornerstone Advisors, and we'll have a lot more to say about this and a whole lot more things. Ron, by the next time we talk, you'll probably have another 3 or 4 articles published in Forbes, and we'll talk about those again. So thanks for being with us again this week.
That's it for this week. If you like the show, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, or share it with a friend, or share it on social media.
You can listen to all of our more than 300 episodes, plus all of the other shows from Provoke.fm Media, and learn more about being a guest, a partner, or a sponsor, all at Provoke.fm.
We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.